What's going on, everybody? You're now listening in to the Truth Paste Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Jesse. To all of you listening in for the first time, I appreciate it. What's good? To all of you who have subscribed, shout out to you. On today's episode, we got something special. I got my homeboy Mikey McLaren on the podcast. This guy's like a Jamaican. My guy does everything, bro. Straight up and down. But I got him on the podcast talking about his path from, you know, making music, putting out mixtapes, his path as a host and an MC, traveling around the country, doing concerts, and then what he's doing right now with some marketing and branding stuff for a spot called Spin down in Seattle. Another episode of Real Talk, man. I'm just trying to bring people on that are doing some cool shit in the hopes that they can drop some gems about their process and kind of lighten up the pathway for those who are maybe trying to go the same way. As always, man, real people, real topics, real talk, real funny. It's Truth Paste. You know what it is. Brush up.
What's good? What's good?
Skinny!
What's good? What's happening?
Man, appreciate you hopping on the podcast.
Oh, you already know. I appreciate my Wi-Fi for not following me outside.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that would have screwed it all up. That's the worst when you've got Wi-Fi connected, but it's one bar. That's worse.
That's my house.
Yeah.
My Wi-Fi is playing double dutch at all times in my house. It's sometimes lit for like 10 minutes straight, just the best sequence ever. And then sometimes they can't even get over the rope.
See, then you play the frugal game of it's like, am I going to use my data for what it is I'm getting ready to do? Because my data is going to be faster.
Exactly. If I tether to my phone, it's lit. But then I'm like, oh, I'm also tethering to my bank account. Okay.
Exactly.
Are we running that risk today?
I don't like tethering that.
No, not at all. No.
Well, let me run into this intro real quick. So for those of you listening right now, you've probably been to one of this guy's parties. You've most likely seen and heard him on some stage of some event or concert you've attended. Or maybe you've caught something on his blog, Craving Amazing. Or maybe you happen to have listened to some of his music. Or maybe you've happened to have a couple of fashion tips from this guy, whether it be him working directly with the clothing line, or just his 365 days of different outfits he ran on Instagram for 1 year straight. No repeats. I mean, there's a lot of things that this guy is doing that you've probably been a part of without actually knowing. And I wanted to bring him on the podcast just to kind of talk about how he manages to get his hands into so many pots. But not only that, but kind of the way you maneuver into those pots and then able to kind of balance it into the life that he's created for himself. So none other than my homeboy, Mikey McLaren. Mikey, what's happening?
Yo, Joe, what's good, brother? Man, I appreciate that. That's a humbling and flattering introduction. And man, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. Well, two things. I believe everyone deserves their flowers while they can still smell them. And it's much easier for me to talk shit to you now that I've got good stuff out of the way.
That's funny you say that, because I literally said that same line earlier today. And then I realized that Drake said that on his record. And I was like, wait, am I turning light skin? It's summertime. I should be getting darker.
Damn. See?
How am I?
No, we're meeting in the middle, because I'm getting darker and I'm becoming more and more ruthless with the comments. So,
oh, perfect. Perfect.
Yeah. I'm straddling that line between Drake Petty and 50 Cent flagrant. Like,
oh,
it's just.
Oh, Lord.
That's like when, like, that's the apex predator right there, is like the Drake Petty with the 50 Cent bully. Like,
yeah, I'm gonna leave you alone for the rest of the summer.
Winter roll around, I'm right back, like quiet Drake, just
right
in my feelings, no Kiki. Well, there's three So there's three things that I kind of wanted to touch on. There's a lot of things that you do and have done, but there's kind of three avenues I wanted to touch on that I think kind of encompass the majority of what it is that you do. So yes. I wanted to talk about your music and the music that you've created. So that being kind of one story, hosting, whether it be like clubs or concerts, that story. And then what you're doing right now, the majority of what you're doing right now, which is like strategic marketing and brand strategy for a number of different people, but spin being the focus right now. So right. I'll let you kind of tell this story first. So out of those three, what came first?
So of those three, I would say that, I mean, I think that I've always kind of been one of those creative and really like inquisitive minded people that has been interested in a lot of things all at the same time. So I would really say that the strategy and marketing aspect probably truthfully came first over everything. But my love for music has been there since day one.
Shout out to the background music of downtown Seattle, by the way.
Oh yeah, you hear that? Yeah, you know, that's what we do out here in these downtown Capitol Hill streets.
That's,
you know,
the perks. That's the perks of living downtown, right?
It's so real. It's beautiful. People ask me all the time, like, so, you know, how's it like down there? I'm like, well, ask the people at the hospital because it's live over there.
Yeah, stays busy,
right? But yeah, I would say between everything, originally, excuse me, originally, I started really getting into music even before I was into, you know, middle school, high school. Kind of the iconic or what you would say the traditional way, of course, at the church. My mom would always, you know, try and get me to sing at the church. I come from a background of family on both sides that have a lot of musicians in them, and so
it just kind of came natural.
Yeah, it kind of came natural. My mom used to run with this band. Some of the old heads might recognize this name.
Shout out to moms too.
Oh, for sure. Mama E does her thing forever.
The real gangster of the family.
Oh, she's really real though. So, yeah, she used to run with this band back in the day when she was really actually on her gangster shit, when she was running with the Panthers, the Black Panthers.
Yeah.
Let's leave it right there.
Let's make it clear which Panthers.
But, yeah, she's run with this band called Cold, Bold, and Together. And the old heads might recognize that name because the famous jazz musician Kenny G was also a part of that band back in the day. Word. So I've been like, you know, when I was at home as a super duper adolescent, we had records of all types in my house and music of all types in my house being played at all times. So it's interesting because that aspect of my life plays into the idea of me trying to be as versatile as possible. I really think of myself as a chameleon in a sense, that way, and not in a, you know, sometimes that term or that kind of ideal can be viewed in a negative way because it's almost like you try to fit in everywhere you go, but it's quite the opposite. It's more of I can fit in or I can relate everywhere that I go, and yeah. I can then take that ability and apply that in a number of different ways. And I think that's the reason why I you know, probably tried to do so many different things and even simultaneously sometimes. But I think through all of that, just the, you know, music is kind of one of those naturally inclined things that you don't, you know, before your mind develops to the point that you understand what it is that you want to do, you already have the ability to do some things. And I think music is one of those things where I was 5 years old and able to sing a song and, you know, hold a tune when my mom's at home having me sing, you know, the national anthem, even though I would never sing it now, of course, but I had to throw that in there. But
let's make it clear.
Let's keep it real clear. But yeah, so, you know, like stuff like that and just whatever, like singing Michael Jackson and singing James Brown, and as I got a little bit older, you know, singing the Red Hot Chili Peppers and singing Stevie Wonder and Brian McKnight and just whatever these songs. And this is like, you know, at 6, 7, 8 years old. And that was really my first, I guess, true love and first calling. It was just kind of one of those things that came natural. And over time, I really just took that and just continued to, continue just to do it really just out of the love. And eventually it got to a point where people were like, you know, you should do something with this music. You have this gift and you should take this and try to apply it to something. And I made a couple attempts at it, and it wasn't for any lack of effort that, you know, we've done and we're here now, and we had some mild success with it. I definitely have never taken it and really just put it full fledged just on the front seat, on the hot seat, and ran with it. But I think that has to do with the going back to the whole being kind of like jack of all trades, where I don't ever want to like box myself in that way. But I think it's one of those things where I'll always come back to it. And I'm making some working on some new stuff right now, actually. And hopefully we'll release some of that stuff soon.
Okay, so we're gonna back it up a little bit,
right?
And because I've heard your music, so for those who haven't, how would you describe your music?
So my music is the stuff that I've released so far. Is a really wide mesh of hip hop, pop, a little bit of indie rock, mixed with some electronic elements as well, kind of like a newer age, kind of hip hop style. So I think that what you would compare it to the most in what we have, you know, at our disposal in this current state would be the likeness of a Anderson .Paak, of a Jaden Smith, of a little bit of a Maroon 5 mixed into that, Robin Thicke, mixed with, I'm going to obviously Drake and the Childish Gambino. And I think that's kind of like that sound that I've always had. The Pharrell mixed into that a little bit as well, kind of more so the NERD Pharrell, so than the singy Pharrell. I do that kind of stuff, but the stuff that I've released so far kind of little bit leans more towards like the NERD sound, which is my favorite band that I've, you know, grown up with and got older with over the years. And that's what I've done so far. I go under my last name as my stage name for that, which is McLaren. And I think that's a pretty iconic name, just given obviously the
Benz, don't sue me.
You know it is, right? Yeah. Please do not. You know, we're in the U.S. McLaren Motors is in the U.K. So, you know, we got them statute limitations across the pond.
Yeah, we straight.
They can't touch me. I'm untouchable.
I already looked into it. Fuck with me.
Exactly.
But don't fuck with me at the same time.
Facts.
So was what the first rhyme or the first song that you wrote, was it a rap or was it like a ballad? Was it pop? What was it?
So I wrote some poetry first, and it was like singing poetry. So it was almost like a falsetto. It was like a, think like, almost on some like
the dream,
like, yeah, like on some dream. Like, no, but it was like, seriously, it was like on some like slower, like a prose.
Okay.
If people like understand poetry, like a prose. It was a very like, you are the weird, like, you know, like,
okay,
kind of like that.
Yeah,
and like,
yeah,
that never came out. That was more like internally, like, oh, you know, I got this crush at school and I'm gonna run up on her and sing to her. And
yeah,
it worked. It actually worked, but that was like,
it
more
always
like,
works. I've done that.
Exactly. And so, so that was the first thing. But then the first actual thing that I wrote and recorded, I still remember it. And that was a rap. And I'll give you the first like four bars. I said, they say the world is my oyster, but I don't like shellfish. I'm into that green like the Celtics.
Ooh, okay. Let's talk about it. Hey.
And then
holds true today.
Exactly. It never changed. And so that was the first one that I actually put on wax and recorded. From there, we had a little crew down in Tacoma, and we started making songs. We made an anthem for our school, actually, called the Dirty Bird Anthem, because our school mascot was the Cardinals. And we made this song. It was the
hold
beat
on, hold
from,
on. You got to shout out the school. What school?
Oh, shout out Franklin Pierce.
Okay.
Home of the Cardinals. Parkland, Washington. Stand all the way up.
I'll let you get that in. Everyone gets their set.
If y'all ever watch Cops, we on there multiple times, many times over. What's up? My apartments were there. I might have been in the window or something. Pause it.
What you want? What you gonna do?
You know what's crazy is the dude that wrote that song. His son, him and I worked on some stuff back in the day.
Really?
Back in the way back, yeah. When I used to work for this magazine here in Seattle, he came up for a party. We threw a party with him one time, and his son, he goes by Lunch Money Lewis. He's actually really
that's kind of
dude.
A fire name.
It is. He's actually a fairly successful songwriter. He has a couple of his own stuff, his own songs that he put out, but he has written some heat. Like, there's a lot of bigger songs that you would recognize his name, and you recognize those songs. He wrote them. He's dope.
That's crazy.
It's crazy. So, we had a little group in Tacoma, and we started recording stuff, and we made this anthem for the school. And it kind of went viral in Tacoma back before social media was a viral thing. And everybody at the school was singing this song. And apparently the rumor is that this song is still known at the school as recent as 2012, 13. And this was done in 2004, I believe. So, the name held weight for a little bit with that little track that we did. From there, I moved to Seattle after high school and started working on some stuff here. Put a couple of mixtapes out. Those mixtapes got a lot of buzz on the net. Amassed quite a few followers and streams on SoundCloud. Tons of blogs picked it up. And then I just kind of stopped, honestly. I kind of stopped. There's a number of reasons why that we don't got to get into specifically, but it was just more so like, you know, things changing in terms of who I was working with and who I wanted to work with. And from there also, you know, we had some other big stuff popping that, of course, Joe, you were also involved with, that we had some other cool projects and companies that we were doing at the same time that were really kind of jumping off. So I made the decision to kind of take a pause on that stuff while those things were starting to really bubble and explode. And that was where that was. And then in the meantime, I was still actually kind of working behind the scenes with some artists and stuff, doing the stuff with working with Red Bull and stuff. There were some artists that were under their belt, and then some people that were producing and stuff here that I helped produce some tracks with that super low key didn't tell people about this or nothing like that. And some of these artists helped write for artists and stuff like that, and that was just like my own kind of like outlet at the time, because I didn't want to necessarily put myself out there as an artist. Just like recently I've decided that I wanted to kind of go back that route again. It's always a struggle with me, because my thing has always been, as an artist, you almost like get the raw deal through all of it. So it sucks, because being so knowledgeable of the whole, really, we won't call it what it is, of the whole game from all sides, I peep game, and I realize that, like, honestly, and everybody knows this that really knows anything about, you know, the music industry, 95 to 98% of your artists don't see a penny's worth of what they're actually doing. And we're talking like to the degree of the guys that are, you know, at the top. MC Hammer's broke, just to put it in perspective. You know what I mean?
We saw the deal. We saw the shit that Wayne was going through with Baby.
There you go. So for me, it was like always like, okay, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to have, you know, all these people around me that are going to eventually take, you know, a piece of this. And it's not always that they're taking advantage of the person. They truly do, you know, like really respect the artist and want to see them be successful. But the way that it's set up, that's just how it is. If you are if you're a bank and this person makes a deposit and then the bank goes under, well, you know, I still like you. You're still my friend. Can we be friends? Can we still be friends? Right. And it's kind of, it's what it is.
Are we still cool?
Right. And it happens like that sometimes, man. Like, oh, hey, man, I had your bag. I know you gave me your bag. I had it. And then, man, these wolves came in and they like told me I had to give them the bag or this. They're going to eat my children.
Exactly. And, I can't do it.
I can't give them my children, but you can get another bag, right?
So one thing that I've kind of learned about you over the years is that you've always been someone that's, one, always had multiple streams of income, and two, has never relied solely on one hustle to make the whole machine work. Right. So as you're going through the music, you're still like, you know, I remember you started to actually get bookings and requests for you to show up places for that. And then you put that to the side because your hosting actually started getting a lot bigger.
Yes.
And I had the opportunity to kind of watch you take the next step from going local to national. So let's go from the beginning. I guess we could talk. We definitely got to talk about the Red Bull 3 style. Cause to me, maybe there was another moment for you, but for me, that to me was kind of the moment where I think you took the next step in kind of one, understanding your worth, but then understanding like, I can actually do this. Like I can hang with all the people nationally. Like I can actually take this on the road. And then we could, we definitely got to talk about the Drake versus Kanye, because I think that kind of encompasses everything that you were doing in the beginning and kind of how you're able to almost perform like you're doing your music without actually having to do your music. It's like a whole different kind of lane that you've created. So how did you get into like hosting or emceeing?
Man, the hosting thing is the one thing of everything that is like such a enigma and like just anomaly even for myself. And this is, you know, coming from a person that has done everything under the sun. Literally, I've done everything under the sun, I feel like, at this point. And it's just, even now, I'm just still kind of in awe of the whole thing. It all happened originally when I was working at that magazine that I talked about before. And we used to throw these huge parties in the city. And these parties, we're talking like huge names, like at the times when they were at the peak of their careers. We're talking Ludacris and Neo and LMFAO and Far East Movement and Little John and Miguel, right after Miguel like really blew up. And
yeah.
Trey Songz and Usher and just all these crazy names. And one time at the party, and this was when we brought LMFAO, my boss at the time, I was the marketing director for the magazine. And my boss, who is the editor in chief, he's my direct superior. I was always just under his wing with everything. He left to go pick up the artists from the hotel because he went and got them earlier that day. They're at the hotel chilling. He went and left, and we had a company sponsored Escalade at the time. So the option was for him to let me drive the Escalade or to let me hold the microphone while he's gone, because he would be the one MC.
Ain't driving that Escalade.
And he was like,
Nah, hell no, you ain't driving Escalade.
You hold this microphone and then hold this L, because I'm going to take the Escalade and pick up the artist.
You're going to take an extra 15, bending a couple more corners.
Exactly.
Escalade.
You already know what it is. And so I got the microphone, right? And so the irony of it all is that my nickname used to be Mike Check, right? And that was what I would basically go by on a day-to-day basis, because I've always had this really loud and colorful and expressive personality. And basically that was like just who I was on a personal level, social level.
That's
crazy.
Cause
I was that guy.
I always thought that
everybody
came after hosting.
Yeah, no, it was totally me. But if you didn't like know me directly, you wouldn't necessarily know that, because as expressive as I am and as like colorful as I am, I was always like very like selective publicly of who like I associated myself with. And that was just kind of like how it was, just from literally like when I was younger, I was just always like this like oddly like not shy person, but like shy in like a selective way. Like I wouldn't always open up in like in front of everybody, but like if you knew me, I would just do just the craziest stuff all the time. And that was kind of what that was with that. And so the minute he gave me the microphone, I was just like, okay, whatever, I'm just gonna have fun with this. And so I'm just literally walking around the party like I normally do, talking to everybody, but instead of me just talking, I have the mic in front of me holding it up and it's projecting out the speakers too. Yeah. And as, so as I'm walking around talking to people, I'm just like also, you know, whatever, like dancing to the music and talking in cadence to the music. And this is where the whole musical inclination came into play. And I think that is really what sets everything apart with me hosting, is that as a musician and understanding music theory, cadence, timing, structure, all of those things that come into, you know, building a song or building a track or a piece of music, I understood that on like a cerebral level with MCing, to where it's like literally like without even thinking about it, I'm doing what I would do if I was essentially composing a song. And I don't know how to compose, but I, you know, I was in band and I was in choir and I understand, you know, timing and measurements and all that stuff. And it's like somewhere like literally like hidden in my brain still, where I don't use it on a daily basis. I can't read sheet music anymore. And I don't remember music theory to that degree, but I guess it's buried in there to the point where it's
just ingrained in there.
It's crazy. Yeah, it's crazy. So all of a sudden I'm doing this, and next thing you know, I'm standing like in the VIP where I normally am, and everybody's just like literally just like going crazy around that. And I'm like, oh, the artist must be here. And I'm looking and no one's here. And I'm like, oh, really? And it's just me. And everybody's just like going ham. And then my boss comes back in at that same time. He walks over. He goes, what'd you do? And I go, I didn't do nothing. I'm just talking. He's like, oh, all right. He takes the mic back. The artist perform. It's over. So it was fun. Like, oh, my God, so much fun. Everybody's coming up to me after the party's over with, though. And they're like, yo, you killed it. You should be doing that all the time. Why aren't you MCing? You should do that. That's so dope. How'd you do that? And I'm like, how did you do that? That's the question I still get to this day. I can't answer it. I literally can't answer it. It's there's no answer to that, because I can't write this down and tell you what it is that it is, like how that happens. But it's this energy that just somehow escapes when I do that, and it just creates this serious actual vibe.
Let me tell you, it's a skill.
It really is.
Like when I go down south to Atlanta or Houston, these guys that host, the way that they're able to throw phrases in between the song and like hit the crossfader, like it's the timing of that is hard.
Right.
It's really difficult. You know what I mean? You got to have it down. You got to be comfortable with your voice. You got to be able to speak quickly, but like precisely, so people can actually understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
But then at the very end, you have to be entertaining.
Exactly. Yeah. No, it's literally a form of improv.
Yeah.
And that's what I try and explain to people, that it's not scripted there with an improv actor. There are certain methods that they adopt, and then those methods they then adapt into every different series of improv that they perform in. And it's kind of the same thing with MCing, and you understand that, having been an MC, that you could be in a room with a crowd that just came from a baseball game and it's a full room, but that crowd is completely different than a crowd that just came from a Boosie concert.
Absolutely.
It's completely night and day.
You
and
usually have the baseball crowd. I usually have the Boosie crowd.
There you go. Exactly. You already know. And so to be able to do both, it's literally improv. You do the same thing, but you do it differently. And that's the only way to explain it. You have to see it to truly understand. And so, yeah, from there, basically, the next party, James gave me the mic and like watched for the next hour. And after that, my boss was like, do you want to just do this every party? And I'm like, yeah, let's do it.
Was that your first party on the mic?
My first time ever on the mic.
Man.
So 100% have James, shout out James, my guy, for all that, because he created a monster.
Yeah, that's when you got bit by the bug.
That was it. And so from there, I started getting booked for a bunch of stuff in Seattle. And it was actually like great timing too, because we actually expanded our magazine down to Portland at that time too. So we were doing these parties down there, and I was emceeing parties there.
I forgot about that. That's right. Yeah. I went to one of those.
Exactly. So the one that you went to actually was not the magazine's party. That was our clothing company party that we threw. Me, you, who else came down? I think like three or four of us came down and we threw that whole party with that other crew down there. And so, yeah, it was like the best timing ever, because I was able to go down there and really like amass like a whole crew of people that knew what I did. And that's, I think that's kind of how the word spread regionally. And, you know, everyone talks between the cities, between Portland, Seattle, for the lesser part, Vancouver, and for the even lesser part, San Francisco, that whole Northwest kind of pocket right there. And so I started getting reached out to by people in the city, and they're like, hey, like, we'd love to have you do this and do that. And I used to have a partner in crime originally after I first started doing it. And that was my best friend at the time. We went by Michael Jordan. My name is Michael. His name is actually Jordan. And it was like on some like new school kid and play shit. Like it was the dopest like thing ever. Cause he did the exact same thing I did. But like slightly different, but like, you know, it meshed so well. And then, yeah, unfortunately he just was not like about it like that. And I just, you know, we just kind of just stopped doing it. But yeah, from there, I just kept getting even more stuff. And then that was when Red Bull decided that they wanted to do a DJ competition.
Okay.
This was about 3 years into me hosting and emceeing events. At that point, I had done mostly just club stuff.
Hold on, because you're underselling it. For a few years, this guy Mike had the city on lock when it came to hosting. Right, so true. There was he's.
We have the Monday night party.
He's being humble, so I'm gonna go. I'm gonna go ahead and shout out my guy, because
give him the laundry list.
There was a stretch for like 2 years where, if he was there, that was the party you wanted to go to, and he was smart. Mike was smart enough to. It's funny, I'm talking like you're not listening. like I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to an audience. He was smart enough to understand that the best parties were the parties led by the people working in the industry.
Right.
And for those of you who have not worked in the nightlife industry, it's a very small group. It's a very private group. And we don't post where we hang out.
Right.
We only communicate with one another. But those events are the events you want to go to, because who better to throw a party than the people whose job it is to throw parties every week?
Exactly.
So we used to have these ragers on Mondays.
The wildest thing you could...
Because think about it. How many, not, you know, your average club goer is not going to go out on a Monday.
Right.
But we are. You know what I mean?
It was crazy.
We are, because we've worked Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Right.
And we need something.
It's time to chill. It's time to kick it. Exactly.
We all need to come back together. And that's where a lot of networking happens. That's where a lot of collab parties happen. That's where a lot of, like, networking, as far as like exchanging contacts for artists and talking about rates and just all kinds of stuff, right? Just a giant think tank. But the way it was set up, it was nuts, because at its finest, I would say Mobar Mondays, legendary when it was like full top and bottom popping. And the crazy thing is that it was quiet at first, and then the public started to find out about it, and then the lines started to form. And it used to be like easily, like it got to the point where if you weren't inside by 11 o'clock, it was going to be an issue.
Yeah. We'll talk to you later at that point. We'll see you next week.
Yeah. Because we're working on some one in, one out shit for the rest of the night. And you know, you're not going to get in.
The time I knew it was just a wrap for that whole thing was there was a night in the winter, and it was set to snow already before the night started. Everyone knew it was going to snow and it was going to start dumping. So we said, okay, we're going to open up anyway. All of us lived downtown at the time. So we're like, whatever, we'll open up. Everybody that lives on the hill will come out. It'll be like the old school industry night. There'll be like 40 people there. We'll get lit, drink some hot toddies, call it a night. And I get there late because I'm just like, whatever, like, it's just going to be a chill night anyway. I get there probably at like 10:45 to a line around the block, and it's dumping snow. My car almost didn't even make it up the hill. It was snowing so bad.
Yeah.
And there was a line around the block, and there were literally probably 70% women in line dressed in mini skirts.
Yeah.
In 29 degree weather.
It was the most exclusive public party going on in Seattle at the time.
It was at that point I realized it was a wrap for all that.
And then where did it move after that? Because it moved somewhere for a short minute and then just died.
And then it just disappeared. So what happened was, this is kind of like a deeper story, but basically the dude who ran Mobile Mondays wanted to get more money to help, like, basically get more support for the night, have more DJs, have another photographer, and basically get everybody a raise. And the venue
didn't want to give Brian O and his photography too.
Oh, Brian O, man, that was really his claim to fame. The same kind of way, honestly, it was that,
because and that was a part of Mobar Mondays too. Like, it was a different kind of photography than anyone was doing. Like, he was catching the candid shots. Like, just the imagery looked and fit what that night was all about. Like,
it was very much like, there's a viral photographer now who goes by Kirill, K-I-R-I-L-L. And he's super well known for throwing these parties in LA. And he just has like the weirdest, most like raw photography, but like specifically the This Is Love It.
Yeah.
And it's just like the craziest thing ever. The girls get dressed up for it, and if Kirill, like, his brand is called Kirill Was Here, and so that's like, if you see that, you know, oh, this is crazy. That's what Brian O was doing.
Yeah.
He was doing what you call now, before it existed, viral photography. That's what he was doing for an event, though, which is crazy because that's typically something that's reserved for, you know, the gram just has these photographers that are just posting viral photos all the time that are really crisp and raw, super high resolution, and it's just a scene in downtown New York at 1 a.m. of a dude on the street in a fucking Superman outfit, right? Or just whatever. And he's doing this, but in a club. So it's people dancing, trying to like look good, look their best, whatever, and super raw, but like super high res, just the cleanest shots ever. Yeah, it was the dopest element added to a party that I've probably, honestly, to this day, ever seen.
Yeah. That was a whole nother element to that party.
Yeah, with no effort. And it's just like, yeah, so like between that and just like what it, like just like that whole just like temperature we built, it was just the craziest thing. And that night with the snow was when I knew it was a wrap. It was so packed.
So that shut down, and then all of your energy and focus went into a much larger venue in Seattle's Belltown.
Right.
That was popping for years.
Right. So right after that shut down, there was this party that I did on the hill that was called Good Saturdays. And that was a series that ran for 4.5 years. That was this just like crazy party. And I think kind of this all goes back into the same thing I was saying before about being like a chameleon. This allowed me to tap into multiple markets within a market. If that makes sense. The Good Saturdays crowd was predominantly Asian crowd. The crowd at the club in Belltown, which doesn't exist anymore, was very just like kind of a just universal crowd. A little bit of everybody, all walks of life from Seattle. You had people coming from the south, coming from the north, coming from the east, coming from the west into downtown. And Belltown at the time was the most busy neighborhood with the most clubs. This was the busiest club in that neighborhood. And yeah, we threw this party. So I had like those two parties. And then I had the Monday party. And then I had like these just like random one-offs that I would do all over the city. And so I was like tapping into every single market, meeting all these different people all the time, but also being known as throwing the hottest event no matter what night it is. Where's Mikey at? To this day, I get calls from people. Hey, where you at tonight? man, I haven't been doing anything on Mondays in like, shit, like 4 years, 5 years. People are still calling me to just, oh, I'm back in town. What's popping? Is Monday still going? Sorry, man. Like, that's how lit it was that people remember it from back then.
It was crazy.
And like, it was crazy. And so, yeah, from there, that party in Belltown was just same thing, just stupid. Every single weekend, we had all the athletes there from the professional teams all the time. And between that and the Good Saturdays party that was up on Capitol Hill, that was when I was introduced to a few different people that kind of, that's what catapulted me to being that like national level where I was starting to get my name spread out to places where it would not have been if I wasn't, you know, being referred by these specific people. So I met this one dude at the Good Saturdays party, and he worked for Red Bull, and he was a, he was on the experiential marketing team for them, but for the whole like West Coast. And he helped out with brand campaigns for big events. And they were doing like larger scale events, like sporting events and big concert series events and stuff like that. And he hit me up because Red Bull was planning their second annual DJ competition. They had done one the year before, but they wanted to start doing it in regional areas first and then doing like a national final in one city each year and rotating cities every year. So the first year, this was my probably at the time biggest event that was a specifically like produced event, not just like a club event that happened to get super popping in a big spot. This was the biggest event that was produced that way. That was a ticketed event that I ever did. And that event had probably like 1500 people there for it. And we're talking like big, big names. The judges for the event were Jazzy Jeff, DJ A-Track, Z Trip, and it was all crazy. Legends. All legends, legendary DJs. And so I hosted that whole thing. It was super cracking, and everyone just like thought it was great. But it was cool because this was much different than me emceeing a party. This whole thing was scripted. So imagine me on stage, kind of like a game show host, or imagine me like Wildin' Out, like Nick Cannon on Wildin' Out, or like Carson Daly on TRL, or AJ and Free on 106 and Park, where I'm holding note cards in my hand with all the details and scrolling through those cards while talking into a camera while also engaging with everybody in the crowd. And it went off without a hitch, but that was my first time to actually like really like dig into kind of a, you know, that next element that I can bring to the table. And that, you know, that's the ability to really have that poise and like stage presence that way, and not just be this person that's going crazy in the club and throwing back shots and throwing drinks off the table and pouring champagne in girls' mouths and stuff like that. Like, this was a real, you know, production.
I was there just to do some promotion stuff for the clothing line. And there were a couple of times I caught myself standing there just watching you pause, like just, you know, doing your thing. And I'm like, man, this guy, Mikey, is taking the next step in this whole hosting thing, because that's not easy to do.
Right.
It's really not easy to do. And it's much different than what you were doing before, but you still... I knew you were great at it when you could take your style of MC from the club and mix it with this scripted version, and it seemed like it was effortless. And I was like, okay, yeah, this guy could take this to much bigger things and on the road if you really wanted to.
Right. And it was like, it was eye opening for me too, because having not had any background in any sort of acting or, scripted work like that before, it was like, oh, I should like really like think about doing this kind of stuff like for real. Because when I was a kid, my dream was always to be, I wanted to be an MTV VJ. I really did. I wanted to be an MTV VJ. I wanted to be Bill Bellamy or, you know, whoever that was on MTV, and then be like Sway and Kurt Loder and like giving the news, but also going out to MTV Spring Break and kicking it out there too, doing both. And like, by the time that I was old enough to be in that position, those things didn't exist anymore. And that's where this kind of came into play. And then I realized, oh, you know, it does still exist, just not on TV. There's things like this happening out there, but I got to find them myself. So right after the Red Bull thing happened, we did our last MOBAR event. So Capitol Hill Block Party came around, and this was crazy because Vitamin Water reached out to us, me and the DJ that used to do MOBAR Monday with me, reached out to us specifically because they heard about us from Cali. This is Vitamin Water that's coming from Coca-Cola HQ in LA.
Yeah.
That's coming up to help produce the Diplo main stage performance at Block Party. And they're like, we need the guys that used to do the party up there that we heard about at the same place. Cause the Diplo party was at Numo's. And we were doing, you know, MOBAR and Numo's are connected. It's all the same building. And so they were like, we want them to open up across the street. And there's this building that's called Soul Repair. That's like a smaller venue across the street. So we're just throwing this party like we normally do our Mondays, but this is on the headlining night of this music festival with Diplo as the headliner. And so our set was supposed to go from 11 to 12:15, and Diplo was going to start at 12:30 and close the night out after that. So we start our set, and it just goes, and it's just a madhouse. I'm standing on top of a giant subwoofer and literally just like going crazy with the crowd. There's one bartender who decides to stop serving the crowd and just is pouring shots nonstop, handing them to me for me to hand out to the crowd.
Yeah.
That's how crazy it was. So by the time 12 o'clock rolls around, we're expecting people to just start kind of like go out. We turn the music off. The crowd demands that we continue to play music.
Yeah.
And we're like, yo, Diplo's about to start. They're like, we don't care. We don't give a fuck. Turn that shit back on. And we turn the music back on. They stayed with us until 1 a.m.
Damn.
And Diplo started at 12:30. So we literally ran over Diplo's set, and it wasn't even promoted that way. It all went viral because everyone found out that it was us that was doing it. It was the Vitamin Water Live Lounge. But then when they found out that it was McLaren and Tiger Beat, it was just a wrap after that.
Yeah.
And everyone just was going crazy. So after that, the next year, we did another Red Bull DJ competition, but this time they did two of them in the same city. The regional was here, and then the West Coast regional was also here. So I did 2 weeks back to back, both in Seattle. That same year, I got reached out to by Budweiser to do the Made in America Festival tour. So the festival obviously is in Philly and LA every year, but that year they did a tour to promote the festival a month before the festival actually started. And they did one in LA, Portland, and Seattle. So I hosted the Seattle and Portland ones, the Seattle one was at a huge, huge space, which is basically where the Seahawks play. It's called WAMU Theater, which is connected to CenturyLink Field where the Seahawks play at. It's a room that holds like 4,000 people.
Yeah.
And I hosted that. So at that point, that was my biggest ever by far.
What's it like standing in front of 4,000 people?
I've to this day, that was just like, I walked out on the stage and like, it was crazy because this is like, you know, it's Seattle. So everybody that's there knows me for the most part. So it's just like, I come out to just crazy cheers. So it felt like being in a concert. And that was kind of like you were saying earlier, that was like the whole idea of like, okay, well now, you know, me doing music, this is kind of the goal. And to be completely honest, even though for me, music has always been art, when I look at it from a monetary perspective, just because my mind works that way, just being in strategy and also being in entertainment, this is where I would want to be, but I'm probably getting the lion's share by hosting versus me having to essentially pay to go on tour, because that's how it works. As an artist, you pay for all the tour dates and you recoup your money at the door. So like I'm getting paid up front for this, and I'm getting paid a premium, and I'm on stage in front of the crowd, in front of a stadium. You know what I mean? An arena.
That's a win.
It's a win. It's a win. And it was, man, it was crazy. It was crazy to see. It was crazy to see. And yeah, that was amazing. And then the next year was when everything just, that was when it went down from that point. So after that, the next year.
And by down, we don't mean down. We don't mean down.
We mean all the way up. So Red Bull hits me up. They go, hey, we're going to do the Nationals on the West Coast. I'm like, bet. They're like, but we're going to do a little bit different this year. We're doing preliminaries in three cities, and then we're doing the Nationals. But we're only doing preliminaries on the East Coast and the West Coast. So everybody from the Midwest and from the, if you want to call it the Mideast, I guess, is going to either coast. So we're only doing three and three, and then we're doing the Nationals. We want you to host everything. And I go, all right, let's go. And that was when I just, at that point, I realized that now it's for real. Up until that point, even though I loved what I did and I take everything I do seriously, but I never take myself too seriously. And at that point, that was when I go, okay, I'm that dude now. I'm that dude. And I could legitimately say that, to the point where I was just like, there's no one else that is on that, in that position, that I can point to go, oh, this is a person that I want to like aspire towards, you know, being like, or getting to that position. There was nobody else. The only other people at that point that were doing anything like that were people who were either celebrities that tried to like parlay their celebrity into getting more money by being a guest at something, or they were people like Fat Man Scoop, Little John, you know, whoever else, Pitbull, people like that, who are really more artists than they are hosts, because they produce and they make actual records and whatever. I'm not doing that. I'm literally hosting a party, and that's what I'm doing. And so I was just like, I've hit the pinnacle, and this is it. Like, there's nobody else. So I was just like, it kind of like, I had to take like an exhale moment, like a deep breath, like, you did it. Like, you did it. And so, yeah, we did the preliminaries. They was in Eugene, Oregon, San Francisco, San Diego, and then the Nationals was in Phoenix. And the Nationals in Phoenix was at this huge resort called Talking Stick. And it was over three nights. And again, everybody was there, as far as like celebrity DJs, all kind of like big, like celebrity artists were there as well. We had a bunch of people that performed, a ton of athletes were there. A bunch of the Phoenix Suns were there. Shout out the homie Bryce Butler. He was there. He's actually a DJ too. He's actually dope. He goes by DJ Duffelbag. If you guys don't know Bryce Butler, the wide receiver for the Cowboys, he has a cracking DJ name actually. But he was there. And it was just like the craziest event. And it was that point that everything that I did kind of, for me, started to like make sense, because until that point I had like my other like projects that I was working on, but it was always just like, oh, this, you know, this is my project I'm working on, or this is where I'm, you know, what I'm working on right now, this is what I want to start working on. But there was nothing that was ever necessarily like, this is what I do, right? Yeah. I was doing everything. And that was at that point that I go, this is what I do. This is it. This is what I do. That basically opened up so many doors in so many ways, that with benefits that I'm still reaping now, you know, 3-4 years later. And
one of those being the Drake versus Kanye.
Exactly.
Which I think is such a unique thing. But once again, it satisfies your, I guess, desire to be on stage performing, but without, right, I guess, the struggle of being an artist and having to pay up front.
Exactly. And even more so than the Red Bull events and the Budweiser and you know, those scripted events, because now I'm literally performing music, even if it's not mine, I'm performing music. I'm literally performing music. It's even more than I am in, when I normally MC, because this is like actual, like basically lip sync the whole time and getting the crowd.
Explain
to do it
what
with
the
me.
What the Drake versus Kanye okay. tour was.
So
how
real
it came
quick,
about and what it is.
Exactly. So real quick before I get into it, shout out to my motherfucking dog, B-Boy Worthing, who set this whole thing up originally. It's crazy how the whole thing came full circle. So they were looking for someone to cover for someone else when they came to Seattle for this party. They had been doing the party for like a year at that point, doing it everywhere in the U.S., and they had someone already, but that person couldn't make it because of whatever reason, and they couldn't come. So they got to Seattle. They were scrambling trying to find somebody.
Kicking himself in the ass ever since.
Right. And so the dude hits one of his boys.
You hit
up.
Old boy with the Tom Brady to the Drew Bledsoe.
I had to do it to him. I had to do it to him. It's not my fault.
five, 6 rings later.
It's crazy. And so they hit somebody up. And what's crazy is the dudes that started this party, oddly enough, it's like such like a full circle 6 degrees thing. They're, one of them is from Seattle originally. He left Seattle and moved to LA to start this record label. And they came to Seattle, hit like one of their random homies up who used to live here. And then the word got to the next person, to the next person, to the next person, to the next person, to B-Boy. And when I say that many nexts, I literally mean 6 degrees. Like it spread that far. To B-Boy, who said, oh, I got a guy. And then B-Boy hits me up and goes, hey, these dudes are looking to do this, this, this. So I'm like, oh, bet. Okay, cool. What is it? He tells me what it is. I'm like, oh, tight. So I call the dude. He's like, yeah, so we don't want you to, like, host, like, MC. We don't want you to, like, hype man it. We want you to, like, perform. And I'm like, so you want me to be Kanye? And if anybody knows me, for those that are listening that do know who I am already, you know what it is. I ain't got to say nothing. Like, Kanye is that dude to me. Like, Pharrell is if Pharrell is number one, Kanye is 1A. I've always led, like, my, like, lifestyle based upon the way that Kanye expressed his. And maybe not so much anymore, but we all remember the old Kanye. I miss the old Kanye, too. And that was
saying is some wild-ass shit.
Right.
But them shirts he was wearing in Wyoming were fire. And I'm just so conflicted with Kanye. Like,
I got a couple of them shirts on the way. I don't know if I can rock with him, though. I can rock with them shirts, though.
Them shirts is hard. But this so hard. Is crazy.
He's nuts, bro. But, yeah, so I was like, oh, bet. Let's go. So we do the event. And we do it, ironically, also another full circle moment. We do it at the same spot that we used to do Mobar Mondays. So I'm doing this party in my old building, my old home court. And yeah, it sold out 2 nights in a row, 1,000 people both nights. And everyone's like, yo, what is this? And I'm like, fam, I can't even tell you. I can't begin to explain what exactly this is.
I remember when you did the first night and you were trying to explain it to all of us what it was. And we were like, wait, so are you performing or are you hosting? And you're like,
is it like
I'm
a party? Is it
both.
A club night? What is it?
Yeah, is like, it a party? Is it a concert? Like,
it's both. And the dudes, they freaked it with this. And so the label is Lights and Music. That's who. Essentially, you could say that I'm essentially signed to the label. Like, we have, like, a, you know, a, like, it's a partnership. So, we,
my
guy's
stuck in
Lights
the 360.
It's crazy. I'm lost. But, nah, so they came up with this concept. It's just the most ingenious thing ever. The party is called Drake versus Kanye. Literally, that's what it is. We play Drake's song, Kanye's song back and forth the whole night. I perform most of the song. So I'll be rapping to most of the song with a microphone in hand, like I'm rapping at a concert performing. And
what's the difference? What's the biggest difference between how you perform as Kanye and how you perform as Drake?
Man, I just kind of sit down every time I perform as Drake. I sit down, I fold my jeans up a little bit, and then I take my socks off. I hold the microphone with two hands, and then that's it. And as soon as Kanye comes back on, I switch it back on.
You got this guy, Drake, sounding Charmin soft.
No, but it's crazy, man. Like,
light vanilla candles on stage.
Hey, man, I got them. The Yankees. The Yankee candle. You already know. The apple pie flavor.
Oh, man.
But, yeah, it's the dopest concept, and the crowd really goes ham. I mean, imagine, you know, let's keep it funky. Drake and Kanye have the livest music for the last two, 3 years. So imagine going to a club and only hearing the hottest Drake and Kanye songs for the better part of the night. 2 hours, 3 hours almost.
You could go that long and not repeat a song, no problem.
No repeats for the whole time. It's crazy. And so, yeah, so we're performing up there. It's dope as hell. And we it's lit. You know, it's super lit.
Which city was the most lit?
Yeah, so last year we did a 22 city tour. Now, for those that aren't familiar with the music industry, a 20 city tour is a national tour. You do basically everywhere. So I can go down a list of where we went. Starting with, we went to Seattle, San Francisco, LA, San Diego, Phoenix, Denver, Chicago, New Orleans, Houston, Dallas, Austin, Nashville, Atlanta, Boston, New York, Philadelphia, DC, St. Louis, Kansas City. Am I missing anything? I know, it's crazy. So we were supposed to do Orlando, Tampa, Jacksonville, but literally the week before we were in San Francisco, and the night that we got off stage in San Francisco was the night that the Orlando nightclub shooting happened. So that entire leg of the tour got canceled, obviously, because of that. But it was also just like surreal because we were at a club when it happened. So it's just like, man, if that was a week later, we would have been in Orlando and very well could have been somewhere we were at. Who knows? You know what I mean?
It's exactly.
It was very surreal. But yeah, so we did 18 cities out of the, or 19 cities out of the 22, skipping the Florida ones, obviously. And it was crazy. I think the most lit city that we did the whole tour. So I'll say this. We also did Birmingham, Alabama. So Birmingham actually was
Shout out to Birmingham.
Yeah, it was the most like random part, but like they were actually, it was lit. But I'd say the best city on the whole tour was probably DC. It was wild because that was the smallest room on the tour. So we're talking like when we did this tour, we were doing rooms the size of roughly 1,500 to 2,000 person capacity and selling them all out. Yeah. Oh, we did Vegas too. So to put that in perspective, the people that we were on tour, like basically on the same route with while we were going on tour, these people were like, you know, either the day before or the day after us.
Mm-hmm.
At that time was Vic Mensa,
mm-hmm.
Pusha T, Cam'ron, Big Sean. First, like some of the bigger spots was Big Sean. And then there was
I couldn't help it.
You're sick. There was one more. Who was it? There was one more person. Schoolboy Q.
Yeah.
Schoolboy Q. So just keep like think about that for a moment. We're doing rooms that big with the tour route going the same route as those artists that I just named, which is like, that's why I was like in my head, I'm like, yo, like I'm doing what I would want to be doing, because that's, if you want to say B-list, if Drake, Kanye, whoever is A-list, that's B-list. That's their second in command, essentially. Kendrick is A-list, you know, Schoolboy, Pusha T, you know, not so much Vic Mensa, but, you know, obviously Cam'ron's more grandfathered in. That's B-level artists than rooms.
Yeah.
Big Sean, like, those are big, big rooms. The DC one, though, was a smaller spot, only held about 500 people. Man, but I'm talking, like, just
shoulder
nuts.
Shoulder to shoulder, nuts.
Chicago's always litty, but Chicago, obviously, is very Kanye-biased. The New York show was crazy. Of course, it's New York. And, yeah, Birmingham was popping, too. Birmingham was popping. I will say my favorite one was Atlanta. So the Atlanta show, we pre-sold, like, 240 tickets. And it was a room that held about 1,200, 1,400 people. Right before, the day before the concert, they announced that Gucci Mane is now off of house arrest.
Oh, shit.
Revolt and Diddy decide that, oh, we're going to throw a party at Fox Theater to celebrate Gucci officially being home. So this Fox Theater is right down the street from where we're performing at in Atlanta. Our show has 240 pre-sale tickets. We get there that night. Over the duration of the whole night from 10 to 1, only 45 people showed up because everybody in the whole city went to the Gucci party.
Yep.
But Atlanta was the most popping night, and I'll tell you why. My boy, M16, he produced Duffel Bag Boys. He's super tight, obviously, super well-connected in Atlanta, super tight with Gucci. Everybody in the A, super producer, heavily fucked with by everybody. He hits me up. Yo, I'm here, bro. Where you at? Oh, I can't come. I'm at Gucci. But when you get done, call me immediately. Get over here. I'm like, bet. We close early, which is, it was a blessing in disguise. We ended our party early. I call him. I'm like, where you at? He's like, come down the street. There's a club called Privé right down the street. The after party's over there.
Oh, yeah.
The concert just got out.
I know of Privé.
Oh, yeah. You already know. So I pull up at Privé. When I pull up, there is black Mercedes Sprinter vans all the way down the street. The street's probably a quarter mile long. Black Sprinter vans parked all the way down the street. On the other side of the street is valet, and it's just Ferrari, 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 Lambo,
Black Hollywood,
Lambo,
man.
Lambo, Bentley, Bentley. And that was when I realized this is Black Hollywood. That was my first time ever in Atlanta.
For those of you guys who have not been to Atlanta to experience it, like, it's different down there, boy. It's Black Hollywood for sure. It's different.
I walk up, it's just, oh, bad ones everywhere, tail out.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's crazy. It's crazy. I'm just seeing
LaFleur's home.
The baddest broads, all flavors. And then I look over and it's Chains, 2 Chainz, his whole entourage standing right there. I text my guy. He's like, oh, walk up to the front. I show security the text. He's like, bet. Right at the same time, walk in with 2 Chainz and entourage and then go in. C16 shows me mad love, introduced me 2 Chainz. It's my guy, McLaren. He just performed down the street. At whatever, I forgot the name of the place, but he immediately knew what the place was. Said, oh, babe, you performing over there? I was like, yeah, man. He's like, oh, okay, I see you playing. Yeah, yeah, what's up? Welcome to the city. You know, first time here? Yep. All right, let's get a drink. Whatever. Boom. Kicking it with them. Everybody's there. Everybody.
Yeah.
Dolph, Migos, Gotti, Gucci, Diddy, 2 Chainz. Everyone you could think of is there. And then, halfway through, Drake walks in. Okay, Drake's there too. Cool. Everybody's there. And, yeah, we kicked it until, like, almost 6 in the morning. I had a flight at 7, so I had to dip. But, yeah, it was surreal because, like, again, that happened, like, and obviously, like, my connection to 16 didn't come from doing those shows, but it was just, like, being in that element, you know, as a career almost, it was already kind of just – it was bound to happen eventually or something like that. And the timing was just perfect. And that was the same thing that would have been the case had I been a performing or touring artist.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's this weird, like, almost like I'm not hesitant to make music, but I'm just like, what's the point? I'm already doing that. You know what I mean? Like, it's crazy, though, because just like that, you can't make that kind of stuff up. And
No. It's
just like the weirdest experiences how that happens. It was wild, man.
Yeah. I got some crazy Atlanta stories, man. People stay pulling up all the time at clubs. It's crazy down there. It's a different kind of thing.
Yeah.
So you get out of, man, if you do, let me know. I'll go with you.
Let's go.
So shout out to Waffle House one time, man.
Oh, you already know.
Sheesh. Shout out that Grand Slam.
Simply the best.
There's no better deal on the face of the earth. You know what I mean? Like, break a 10 and you getting a double breakfast. This shit is out of control.
Oh, you won.
Right? So you come out of that and then you start going into this branding role with this new concept of, I don't know if it's nightlife or if it's a lounge, but you always seem to find yourself in the beginning stages of these brand new ideas. So talk about, like, we'll finish up with talking about what is it that you're doing right now.
Perfect. Yeah. So upon this whole kind of wild ride of emceeing, I've just been introduced to so many different people, and those connections have just been continuing to just, you know, eventually connect over the years. The most recent one is with a friend of mine out of New York who is friends with the founders of this concept that I'm now a part of. And what it is it's a place called Spin. And the concept started in New York with these two dudes that used to own this loft in Tribeca. They used to throw these parties, and it was different because they had a ping pong table in their loft. And so they would throw these parties, and it's kind of, what's crazy is they tell this story, but low key, I feel like the story goes way deeper than what they explain, because they would throw these parties and they were called naked ping pong parties because they would play ping pong, but it would be strip ping pong. So kind of like, imagine like strip poker, but like ping pong, where every time you don't score, you take off an article.
Yeah, you got to be careful, because
what the hell are y'all really doing?
Some of my subscribers have heard the story about the ping pong shows in Thailand, and they still might be traumatized from that one.
Man, look. So you're getting... I heard that one too. I'm leave it at that. Yeah, you know, like, I don't know what they were doing. Like, what were y'all doing with these naked ping pong parties in the loft in New York? But
living our best life.
Living it. Whatever they were doing, it became this iconic thing. One of them randomly, and this is another, like, who knows how it came about, but one of them started dating Susan Sarandon.
Okay.
So she started bringing her celebrity clients.
Not the name I thought you were going to throw out.
Right. It's crazy. And she's definitely, for her sake, rocking the cradle, because she's,
yeah,
I believe, 15, 20 years older than this dude. But, yeah, started dating her, and she started bringing through whoever, you know, Zuckerberg and Bieber and JT and Jessica Biel and all these crazy people, Michael Strahan, like the wildest names to this loft. And all of a sudden they're like, yo, we got something here. And they create this concept. And so Spin is the brainchild of that party that became this now social destination that is a very unique hybrid of a nightlife experience, of a sporting activity, of a social experience, of a just like a community lounge, and like a also an art space. So it's a number of things combined into one, where it emphasizes culture, it emphasizes activity, sporting activity, specifically like a sporting event. It emphasizes nightlife and entertainment, and it emphasizes lifestyle. And so you have this really interesting mesh. But what's crazy is that, like, this is one of those things that is so right up my alley.
Yeah. That's
literally everything that I've really been kind of involved in my whole life, but especially like professionally, that's what I've been doing. My creative agency, Craving Amazing, that I've had for 4 years now, we specifically work in brand strategy. And so we work with a number of different brands on both like brand strategy and creative direction, from smaller brands, local restaurants and clothing boutiques, and even like local like music labels, to larger, you know, companies like Adidas and a couple of other, you know, apparel companies out in New York, and the record labels in LA, and, you know, a couple different artists just across the board that we work with through that. And so, like, I've already been involved in that. And then for years, that's just been my thing. I've worked in marketing for basically my entire professional career. And so it's always been in me. And this like literally is like almost like a like embodiment of me in a space, because you have the art aspect, you have the activity aspect, you have the entertainment aspect, and then you have the musical and kind of performance aspect all mixed into one. And so I was introduced to these guys through a connect that I had from emceeing parties when I went out to New York a couple of times and emceed some stuff back in the day. And they basically reached out to me and said they were opening up a spot in Seattle and they wanted me to be involved. They originally didn't quite know who I was. So I showed them the work that we had done with Craving Amazing and showed them our content platform now and what we do in just terms of just being kind of like a aggregate content platform that just, you know, kind of shares news and information about current events and current trends and things like that. But then also I showed them a background of what I do as a host, as a performer, and some of my music as well. Some of my fashion efforts as well from the clothing company that you and I used to be a part of. And some other things outside of that as well. And so basically they kind of created a position for me. And then that position is now expanded as a position that we have at every location in the company. So we have 7 locations total in Seattle, San Francisco, Austin, Texas is the newest one, New York, Philly, Toronto, and Chicago. And so this position that I had was really a pilot position. I helped build out the entire space here in Seattle. We tapped a bunch of local artists to curate the space. And was in there building it out. It was crazy because I couldn't tell anybody about it the whole time. I had to be on the hush. I told you guys a little early, but that was even after, like, I pretty much had to wait until things were like kind of like signed on the dotted line, the ink had dried, so I could be certain that I'm not jinxing myself.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, you know, we're good now. Let me let the cat out of the bag. And even after that, I was like, don't tell anybody for like 2 months until this is done.
Well, that's kind of what I want to finish up with, is touching on that point. I've got 3 questions, and this is kind of the opportunity for you to drop some gems, just what you've learned throughout your journey, but just some advice for people who may have the same journey as you. So the first question is understanding the moment of defining your worth and how to use that in negotiations for partnerships or contracts or bookings and things of that nature, and then being open to opportunities that come your way rather than kind of limiting yourself to just being good at one thing. And then lastly, kind of the life of an entrepreneur. Your business and, you know, your livelihood is predicated on your being, your voice, your ability to entertain, your ability to have stage presence and charisma, all these things, you know, things that you have to practice, but inherently it's just you. It's not like, you know, a lot of people may not look at it as a skill, but it is a skill. So, you know, talk a little bit about what it's like having to be an entrepreneur where you are what you are selling.
Right. So, yeah. So to answer, I'll answer them in, I guess, reverse order. To be an entrepreneur and to kind of how you navigate what that is.
Because let's be clear. This is how you make your living. It ain't like you got a 9-to-5 you fall back on.
Right.
Like, this exactly. is how you
this
eat.
Is it. This is it, 100%. Yeah, there's no plan B. You know, if this goes south, then it's like, okay, new, completely new piece of paper. There's no plan B written down. Not that I don't have a backup plan, but
as
an entrepreneur, this is what you do.
I think we've established you always got a plan B, C, and D.
Oh, always. right. But yeah, you know, you live, you know, like they say, you know, by the seat of your pants. This is what it is as you do it. It runs as it goes. So I mean, to be an entrepreneur and to establish yourself that way, it's all about I'd say, because like you said, those intangibles are kind of things you can't really explain to someone if they don't have a savvy for being in position and making themselves valuable in that position, or if they don't have a eye for, you know, if specifically if their role would be like trend forecasting, but they don't have an eye for trends, that's not something that you can specifically teach, so to speak. But one thing that you can do, if you know, to be an entrepreneur, is really just to have confidence in your position. You have to be supremely confident in the face of anyone saying you're wrong, because you can be wrong and still have just unlimited confidence to the point where your value retains.
Yep.
And that's the, I think the number one thing and the number one rule that should always apply to anyone that wants to be an entrepreneur is your confidence has to exist. There's a lot of times that you miss the boat on, you know, the trend or on a product that might have been the product that would have taken your business to the next level, or the strategy that would have taken your business to the next level. And you just have to remain confident, because you can be steadfast in, you think that if we completely like dedicate our services to this one specific area, this will be successful. It might not be for 6 years, but if you can, if you show your confidence and you keep your, I guess, your foot in the game that way of just saying, no, we're here, we're here, we're here. You think that we're doing bad. We're not, we're here. Eventually, everything's going to come back and return to where it originally came from. So your strategy mm-hmm. that you have of pointing directly to that specific area eventually will actually make sense. And then it'll start to reap benefits and show results. And so you just have to, in the meantime, stay 100% certain that I know what I'm doing. And that's what you have to say to others and also say to yourself, because that doubt can also come into your mind and say, am I really on the right path? Am I really doing what I should be doing? And it's at those moments that you have to just stay true, because the next day, literally, you can get a call and then there you go. I mean,
it all
completely true for me. Like that, just as an example with the whole spin situation, I had just removed myself from another situation that I was a part of. And I willingly did it, but at the same time, it was reluctant, because I wasn't immediately like ready or had something else to jump right into. So it was like, damn, I really just did that. Well, shit, now what? Now what? And you know, like it was just like, but I know that something's going to happen no matter what it is. Something, and sure enough, literally the next week, I wasn't even in town, I took a vacation, because I was like, I just got to get out of here for a second, because I can't
even
be here in this space, because I don't even know what the hell I'm doing right now. And I'm gone, and I get that call, and I'm like, see, I knew it would come. It was just like, even for that split second of me saying, oh shit, I was like, that was the reminder, like, don't do that. Don't ever do that. And I never do it. Yeah. And like, that was every blue moon. And I was, yeah, don't do that. So you just got to really just believe that you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, and you'll know when you're supposed to be doing something else. And the world will know when that's supposed to happen too. And it'll correlate and it'll connect.
So then talk about that and how you leverage that in negotiating your worth.
So to leverage that, because as an entrepreneur and as a creative in general, there's not a lot of situations where you can truly express real, tangible results into a set of data to go, this is why this needs to happen. Everybody knows across the world, across all industries, that the marketing department consistently has the smallest budget. The marketing director consistently gets paid the least of all of the C-level employees. That, you know, that's the last thing that gets funded, and it's the first thing that gets cut at all times.
First to hire, first to fire.
Period. Exactly. So we all know this, but what you have to do is you have to say to yourself, okay, look across multiple industries, and then you say, okay, which companies are the most successful and why? The companies that are the most successful are always the most successful because they implement the marketing strategy based upon what this person that may not be traditional, but is, you know, 100% certain that it's going to work because they're doing it. And that's, you know, that those are the companies that are successful. Like, but you look at, you know, Steve Jobs with Apple, or you look at just whatever one of these crazy, you know, startups that's come about over the last 5 to 10 years, they all have these really interesting and really unique and dynamic strategies that come behind marketing. And you can take that same principle and you can kind of take that down to a more micro level and go, okay, this is why this will work. You don't necessarily want to compare it to other things, but you just want to say, I know this will work. And if you don't think it will work, what's the idea that you have that you think would work? And if that person that is across the table from you can't give you an idea, because better or worse is obviously relative, but if they can't give you an idea at all, then A, they're not going to have a choice but to take your idea, or B, maybe you should just probably shouldn't have been there to begin with. You should just go somewhere else because they just don't value you. You have to be okay with knowing that sometimes people just aren't going to value you. That doesn't mean that you are not valuable. It means you need to find the place that will value you.
Facts. I turned up in a job interview when I found out I was getting played. I went full.
I remember you told me Wesley about that. Snyder, I remember that. New Jack City.
Man, I was hot. I was so hot in there because I knew that they valued my information, but they didn't value it enough to offer me the job. They just valued it enough to give my information to the person that they already gave my job to.
The real companies that know that they have a maverick will take it because they understand what that is. And the companies that are A, afraid, B, don't really have any actual horse in the race, or C, are arrogant, won't. And so again, you just have to be able to discern between which ones are really about that life and which ones aren't, because the ones that aren't, they always fall to the wayside. I can't think of a single company that has ever not thought of something in the aspect of like a dynamic strategy that survives. Like, I mean, maybe like some like super super old shit like Heinz ketchup or something like that.
Yeah, something tried and true.
Just
that
completely just like, okay, this will never go away. But anything that's existed in the last 20 to 25 years and still exists now has only existed because of that reason, because of that maverick attitude and having those people involved.
So your black ass want to say anything else before we get off here?
Man, you know what I'm saying? Like, hey, look, I appreciate it. And yeah, you know, you're doing your thing. And I just want to say that I appreciate you as a person. And yeah, you understand this on so many levels. You and I are very much the same that way. And I think that this, I hope that this can convey to others who feel that way and have not necessarily discovered the path that they want to be on, to, you know, just to continue working and continue creating art, and to continue you know, building their portfolios and building their brand and their personal brand, and taking that and getting ready to take the world by storm, because storms don't just happen overnight. A tropical storm turns into a hurricane just like that.
Absolutely. I think for me, the whole purpose behind doing these interviews with people like yourself is I have a firm belief that there is a plan towards excellence and success for whatever it is that you're doing. And I think that a lot of people that reach the top, they're unable to share what that process is while they're in the middle of it because they're busy learning. But I think that if asked the right questions the right way, the answers that they give can unlock that pathway for other people who are listening. And I think for a lot of the people that I have these conversations with, them listening back to their own story is kind of a moment where it's like, damn, I've been through a lot of stuff. I've done a lot of stuff. But then also at the same time, it's like, man, like I've laid quite the path down for anyone else who wants to take this same path. And a lot of times we may forget to share that path with people. And then also, like, you know, lastly, I think a lot of our peers and your friends and your family, they see a lot of what it is that we're doing and may not necessarily know how the hell we got to the point of where we are. So sharing this process gives them a little bit of an idea of, like, one, what it takes, but then two, what it entails. And it's a lot, you know what I mean? It's a lot more than, you know, just Mike out of town again, you know, on stage rapping songs. Right. Like, you know, you got to know the songs. You got to, you know, memorize the songs. You got to think about how you're going to perform certain parts of the songs. You got to engage with the crowd at the same time. Then next week, you've got a wedding where you've got to remember how to pronounce the groom's last name correctly. You got to, like, remember little fun facts about the family during a toast. It just, you know, it's a lot of prep work that a lot of people don't see. So I appreciate you hopping on, man. Pause. I appreciate you, you know, getting on the podcast and dropping these gems for these people, man. It took a minute for us to get this done, but I think we did it properly. We're
here. I love it. I love it. I love it. Bless up. Brush up.
Oh, man. Yeah, brush up. You already know what it is. Gang, yes, gang. Sir. All right, Mike. All right. Thanks to my homie Mikey McLaren for hopping on the podcast for this episode. Make sure you hit that subscribe button if you're listening on Apple Podcast, Google Play, Spotify, Anchor, however you're listening, make sure you hit that subscribe button, or at the very least, leave a rating. 5 stars would be nice. I said 5 stars would be nice. As always, I appreciate y'all because you guys appreciate me. I hear those calls and I get those texts when I'm not putting up episodes. And when you guys do that, it makes me sit down and make sure that I put something out. So continue to do that. I'll continue to do this. And we're going to keep making it happen. As always, it's Truth Pace. Brush up.